You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well.
Do you love sci-fi, horror, and fantasy films? Then grab a badge for Otherworlds Film Festival, the country's premier sci-fi film festival. There'll be Q&As, panels, parties, and mixers. Rub elbows with up-and-coming and established filmmakers, as well as like-minded filmgoers. Come celebrate our 7th year, December 3rd through 6th, at the Galaxy Highland in Austin, Texas. Badges are now for sale at OtherworldsFilmFest.com. That's OtherworldsFilmFest.com.
Time to continue on with a look of the greatest cult films ever made, at least according to this one particular documentary trilogy, which if you watched our Live from the End of the World show that we do on Sunday nights at 8 p.m., video show that we broadcast on our Twitch and Facebook page, we actually interviewed one of the producers, Paul Fishbein, for this, but it was after we did the previous one. I will have an additional little series of question and answer with him at the end of this podcast that you can keep listening to if you want to hear more of the questions that we actually had and posed at the end of our last review for part one, which was Midnight Movies, which is about as ambiguous as you can get. Movies that did not fit into the other categories is more appropriate because this one is horror and sci-fi. And quite frankly, I think you very easily could have done one for each. But obviously people have different opinions, and some of the people might have different opinions than me are here to talk about these films again, just like they did the first one. We've got...
Because we did the time warp again.
Again, yes. So that was Mindy.
Hello.
Next up, we have Harmony.
Hello.
And rounding it out to make it gender equal, we have Adrian.
Hello.
So I'm curious to know, because I know on that first list, it seemed like everybody was maybe in a, like, somewhere between 50 to 70% of them you'd actually seen. Does that right. sound correct?
Yeah.
Or at least knew about.
Well, knew about is different than seen, though. I mean, he's like, details, what? Damn details. It, I'm going to have to take a bunch of movies off my Letterboxd now. But would you say, you guys say you had seen more of this horror and sci-fi list or less than the previous one?
More.
A lot less. I have seen
all of them except for Buckaroo Banzai.
Oh my God.
What?
I want to see that one.
And I definitely want to now.
I'm not so much a horror person, so a lot of the horror stuff I knew about, but I haven't seen because it's not something that would make me happy.
I've caught you enjoying some of the horror movies we've reviewed.
That is true. That is true.
I think maybe you're turning into a horror movie fan and you just haven't accepted it yet.
I suppose change is hard.
We'll make you watch Anna and the Apocalypse and that'll be the final like thing to drop.
Oh my God.
Well, let's go into this list. As before, this is hosted sort of by a little...
quotation marks.
Yeah, kind of, sort of hosted by a group of people who sit and occasionally come in and have some comments to make about the films. I mean, really, it's almost arbitrary. It's so sometimes they're there and they introduce it and sometimes they don't.
Right.
It was only like twice yeah. that they came in on this one. It was so completely random and non-important that they had this little panel. It was really dumb.
There was no reason for them there, nor should they have been the same panel as of people on the first one. And once again, most of the time it felt like these guys did not really know what to say about the films in question. Like, it seemed like a lot of them were like, I haven't even seen that was the feeling I got
yeah.
or have heard of it. But you have Joe Dante, who's probably the one guy who's actually seen all of these films for sure, right?
Right, because he's
got a horror history and he's definitely seen everything on this list. And you have Ileana Douglas, who once again, more than anyone, I have no clue what she's doing here.
Can't the girl.
They haven't had a film on their list I think she was in. Interesting personality, but not sure what she's doing here. Kevin Pollak, who you would think you invite him on because he does impressions of almost everyone. Second movie in, still not a single impression. I don't know yep. why he's there. But then John Waters, who is like almost like if you say cult films in the encyclopedia, there's just a picture of John Waters right
there. They're next like, okay, yeah, you just belong here. He wasn't invited. He just like springs forth and manifests whenever somebody's talking about cult films. I think, oh, look, there he is now. Yeah.
I think he might be right. He's some sort of like nature's god of cult films.
Yes, I agree.
I think there's even a spinoff issue with The Sandman about him. Anyway. this particular collection starts off in the most unsurprising way possible, which is with Night of the Living Dead. People had never seen anything like it, no question, because zombies before that were not... This is zombies as we know them now. That all started right here.
Yes.
Before that, it was like the Haitian zombie. White zombie and stuff like that all came from the Haitian zombie idea, which was sort of like a human who is alive being hypnotically controlled by another person.
Right.
Now zombie is unquestionably this. The only argument is fast or slow. And Jesus, people get stupid upset about that question. Like, they're fictional.
They wouldn't actually live very long. If you stayed in your house for a week, they would be eaten by fungus. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous argument, but walking is definitely better.
I'm a running guy myself. I'm sorry. The moment I saw him run, I was like, well, you can't go back now. We've seen so many slow walking zombie movies that they're fun, but they're not scary anymore. The moment, and I want to say the remake of Dawn of the Dead was the first one with really fast-moving zombies. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah.
I thought it was 28 Days Later.
I guess that's if you don't count 28 Days Later as zombies, which that's a whole nother debate that is not worth getting into.
They're not dead. They're people infected by a virus who are not undead. Whatever. You know,
whatever,
is there a difference? I don't know if there is
one. I hated the whole first half of this documentary.
Did you? Why?
Well, Night of the Living Dead, I think, is a great movie. And then they start, you know, going into Dawn of the Dead, a very visceral, very... I'm not a gory person, you know. I don't know. But I was happy once we got back from Night of the Living Dead to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Then I was like, oh, okay, now I'm back in my okay realm. But all the movies in between...
That's the last one that kind of flips over to science fiction after that.
Yeah.
And Texas Chainsaw Massacre, even alone, there's no gore in Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
That's why
there's
like it.
one second of gore.
It's very subjective.
Yes.
It's not even subjective. It's not on screen.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. It's like all in your head. Like they show you something and then your mind fills in the blanks.
And the stuff they show you that your mind fills in the blanks for is so horrifying that people remembered it at the time as being so much more horrifying and gory than it actually was. I mean, it's like PG in terms of gore. Going back, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, which was the sequel. I mean, I get it. They should have just gone the Dead trilogy because it's like telling that they left out Day of the Dead, which is... Also huge, not as huge, certainly not remembered as well as the other two, but nonetheless, it was like, okay, the Dead trilogy kind of thought of as one product to some extent. But yeah, Night of the Living Dead almost sunk without a trace because A, like I said, release issues. B, no one knew how to categorize it or how to release it. Mm-hmm. It was kind of treated like porn when it came out in some ways. C, black actor as the lead in a time that that was not really a thing that you did as much unless it was specifically a film dealing with race issues.
Oh, what do you know? It actually is that, too.
Well, I mean, it did, but only in retrospect,
yes,
weirdly.
Yes, that's true.
Because Romero said a billion times, we really were not even thinking about that at all.
Yeah.
He was just the best actor.
Yes.
They talk about both those films, which, yes, and a good thing, I'm glad you pointed out, Harmony. Yeah, this gets very gory. It shows some super gory stuff from these films. Even more so when it gets into a not George Romero film, The Evil Dead, the first Sam Raimi release in the Bruce Campbell never-ending series of Evil Dead product, which I personally love to pieces.
Yeah,
that part was the one that in this documentary made me very angry at the way that it was portrayed. It focused on the horrible things that they did to the actors and finding out that Sam Raimi did that. I am an actor and I was horrified. It presented this thing that is perpetuated in the acting and in the arts communities of... You have to destroy yourself in order to create art. It is the Stanislavski method. Like, if I ever had met Stanley Kubrick, I would punch him in his stupid face. I have no respect for him as a director because of what he subjected his actors to.
Yeah.
And to find out that Sam Raimi did the same thing, there's a scene where he's holding a chainsaw over this woman's neck, and thank God it didn't go wrong. Bruce Campbell had a sore in his leg that they literally made worse in order to add to film. There's one thing where producers, like, blood got on the trolley, and, like, that's how you make a good film. And it's presenting this as a positive.
I didn't see that it was presenting it as a positive
at
all.
It was presenting it as a great film and these are great moments.
It is a great film.
It is a great film with great moments.
But that's the thing. It's saying you're having great moments by subjecting your actors to danger and pain. Like, even one of them says Sam Raimi literally tortured his actors. That's what somebody said. And that perpetuates this idea that an actor has to destroy themselves in order to create art. And it is so toxic and so dangerous. And that made me so angry that they were reiterating that message.
I did not get that they were affirming that that was a good thing at all. They were just reporting the story.
Right.
And to be fair, when you look at almost every movie in the 70s, all the directors were doing that shit. And there are famous stories of William Friedkin and Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola all doing exactly the same thing.
Because
it was a moment in time that this was a thing that was happening.
And so someone like Stanley Kubrick, I totally understand that. But in regards to the Evil Dead, I feel like their telling of these stories was more so in their passion for film and doing the movie with whatever that they have at their hands. Not so much of this method of you must give yourself entirely to the art and you have to destroy yourself. I would even bet that that never crossed their mind. I think they were just going off.
And that's the problem, that these things weren't considered.
Come on, there's a point where you have to look at when people are going on a shoestring budget and everyone is coming together, which is what this movie was. It was literally everybody was putting their own money, the people who were working on this film, because they wanted it to do well. This was a seat of your pants. A lot of people didn't even know what they were doing there. It's not as insidious as you're making it out to be.
I don't think they would be telling these stories if they had a problem with it.
I think it's just nostalgic for the movie itself.
Yeah. I think the Evil Dead portion is actually one of the highlights of this documentary.
A lot of passion, very little experience, and that's the sort of thing where people do stupid shit. Noted, he didn't repeat the same issue of being not careful enough on films he did after this. I think really it's just trying to point out how raw this set was and what a miracle it was that this film got the notice it did, which is largely because Stephen King happened to stumble across it and said something nice about it.
Yeah.
Then it moves way forward and talks about The Devil's Rejects, which is the only one of Rob Zombie's films I will give mad props to, which I think is the second film in his trilogy about the protagonists from House of a Thousand Corpses, which I don't think is a good film at all. But this one is a really solid sort of Sam Peckinpah, crazy people on the road film. I remember seeing it in the theater being shocked how much we all liked it.
I really like that movie. It's probably, like you said, the only movie that I will outright praise.
A bunch of people who are old horror icons or people involved in music who are playing these roles. Like a lot of these people we had forgotten about completely until they showed up again in a Rob Zombie film. Like Sid Haig, who just died recently, played Captain Spaulding the Clown in these. He was like an old school sci-fi horror actor in the old black and whites, and this was kind of his big comeback. Ken Forey from Dawn of the Dead, who also speaks in the documentary about this and Dawn of the Dead. But then they go on to The Human Centipede, which I had the weird pleasure of presenting the award for Best of Festival to the director Tom Mix at Fantastic Fest one year. Editorial cut in here that I do, in fact, keep referring to the director as Tom Mix, who obviously was an old cowboy star. Instead of his actual name, Tom Six. Someone else even says it in this review correctly, and I still keep calling him Tom Mix. Apologies.
Oh my God.
That was a weird experience.
Okay.
Tom Six gives a story about how he came up with the idea for The Human Centipede that both sounds like something he made up right there on the spot, and like it's completely true.
Could be legit.
Yeah, I can't tell. I feel like Tom Mix is the world's biggest con man. Having talked to the guy myself and seen a lot of interviews with him, he's got this whole persona thing that he puts on, and you're like, what is this? Like, it's kind of like a cowboy, but from a non-English speaking European country, you know? Like, what is that?
He must have just found a hat somewhere and decided, I'm going to go with this.
He's an odd motherfucker, and I do recommend, people are like, Human Centipede is a lot like Texas Chainsaw Massacre in the sense there's very little actual gore in that movie. Very little. There's a little bit in there for sure, but almost all of it is what's in your head, and that is so unbearable.
Yes.
I mean, it really is. But the second two are atrocious. Like, they are like, he's like, we got to push it further. So it's like that, except what if he had the money now to show all that worst gore situation you could imagine? And nobody wants to see that.
No.
It's not funny anymore. It was funny in Human Centipede. Then it's just depressing in the next two.
No.
I do like the fact that all the cast got to have massages after every day. That's nice.
They move on to Reanimator, which I think is one of the finest splatstick horror films ever made, which is to say horror comedy that has tons and tons of gore in it. And it is very funny. It's very legendary. It's based, question mark, on an H.P. Lovecraft short story, which is to say just barely.
Just barely. Like the same name.
I am intrigued by the stage production. I knew there was one for Evil Dead. I didn't realize there was also one for Reanimator.
I didn't know that either. And there's a little bit of footage of that in here. I was like, okay, very cool.
Oh, I was going to mention that I saw a stage production of Night of the Living Dead here in Austin, and it was amazing. So,
yes, yeah. I remember they did that. Yeah.
I've been wanting to see the Evil Dead one, which they do like a Gallagher show where they have sheets of plastic.
Plastics. They did that a couple years ago, and I didn't get to go. But yeah, they have plastic for people on the first couple rows, the blood zone.
Well, I hope they do the theatrical production right and torture all the actors. Anyway, going on.
Well, bye, Mindy. It was nice knowing you.
No, I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. There's opportunity for a bring it back joke, and I had to take it. Anyway, yeah, Reanimator is pretty hardcore stuff, but it's so goofy that it's hard to be grossed out by it, really, because it's just absurd. Right. It's so fucking absurd.
And also 80s special effects being what they are, you know, it's not as realistic as things are nowadays. So you have, like, blood that's not quite the right color and things like that.
I don't know. I think in terms for Reanimator, it looks pretty visceral. It is silly in the terms of the way that people's skulls just fall apart and things coming out of bodies and stuff like that, but it still looks pretty gross.
Yeah, I was going to say, I find the blood from the 80s and 90s movies much more realistic than the blood today, because it's all digital today, and it never looks right.
That is
not
true.
Once. Yeah. Always looks like, is your blood electric?
It's shiny. It's so shiny.
Yeah, it's too shiny. What's wrong with your blood? And also, one of the cheapest practical effects you can do. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Tell me it's less expensive to CG animate it? I don't understand. Anyway, sorry. I went off on my soapbox there. But yeah, Reanimator, I think, is an all-time classic. But then it moves on to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which, of course, I totally, completely agree. It was popular, but it was popular as a cult film when it came out. I think that's a really important one to discuss, especially because of the detail in which they go into what we were saying, like the way that it can be the goriest thing you've ever seen without a drop of blood in it.
Yeah. It's also the funnest segment of the documentary.
Yes,
aside from the Evil Dead one, which was maybe the best of the whole documentary. I think we all agree on that. the Texas Chainsaw, they go through the home that they use. They look at some of the props.
That was
it's really
sweet.
Great.
Like, I dig that guy.
It's like 40 minutes from here. You can go there. They have like a full anytime.
Barbecue.
They've got like barbecue. Yes. It's a bed and breakfast. It's a museum.
I love the fact that this movie that's about this horrifying family doing horrifying things is now a cozy B&B.
Yes, exactly. It's amazing.
It's so, yes, go, let's have some... I don't know why they have a British accent now. He's like, let's have some tea and crumpets as we keep going with it.
It's more of a barbecue place, but yeah.
It's kind of a tribute to the possibility of imaginative people. Because somebody just went up and like, who is going to want this? Yeah, okay, it's not like you're going to get a historical plate by the state put on it, right? For the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house. Who's going to want it? It's just going to gradually get more and more destroyed by kids coming wanting to take their pictures on the front porch over time. And somebody bought it, was like, I think you guys are stupid. There's a chance to make a lot of money here. And sure enough, he's doing great.
Yeah. Like, the actor who was talking in through that segment, I was just utterly charmed by how much he loved being in that movie and the whole fandom around it. And that's what I really liked. It's like, I like seeing actors who are really into what they've done.
Well, especially with horror and things like that, because you're put in situations that are terrible and terrifying. Mm-hmm. And that was something in regards to all these horror segments, is that everybody was so fond of everybody and everybody had such a wonderful time interacting with each other. And the reason for that is you have to, because you have to create a safe space and you have to get yourself away from this terrible circumstance. So you're like laughing about it and forming bonds that are stronger than what would be like a normal happy thing, because you don't need to.
Right.
There are sets that go exactly the opposite, though,
that
in
is
an
true.
Intentional way, where they're like, I am never going to be able to come up with the level of terror I require unless I go Stanislavski on this bitch.
In regards to Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Reanimator, they speak to both Toby Hooper and Stuart Gordon as well, and I was kind of surprised.
They're both dead.
They didn't put in any kind of tribute. I'm wondering if they'll do it on the official release.
Yeah, this is has a lot of dead people in it.
Yes, I think this guy is killing people.
Starting to think that if you make horror movies, you don't want to be in this guy's documentary
series.
No,
that's what I'm saying. I was like, and now, you know, Fred Willer, who appeared a little bit at the beginning and will definitely be in the next
one,
right. passed away. I'm like, I think there's something. We've got a mystery, guys. We need to solve it.
Yeah, while watching this, if you do decide to rent it, you will notice that it seems like they've taken a lot of time to make this.
Yes, yes.
Well, they go next into science fiction with Death Race 2000, which is one of those ones I took for a weirdly long time to get around to. I don't know why. I think it just looked so stupid.
It's
I was
so
like,
silly.
I don't want to see that when I was growing up.
Well, it's essentially Grand Theft Auto, only in movie form. Well, I mean, the way a lot of people like to play Grand Theft Auto.
Yes. I mean, other than running over people, I would say it's not like Grand Theft Auto at all.
If you want to be really nerdy, it's more like Carmageddon.
True.
Yeah. Well, it's like, that was the thing a lot of people did. They just liked to run over old ladies, and that became a thing.
Yeah.
Well, in Death Race 2000, the story being basically, it's now, society was economically destroyed, and they started to bring it back by bread and circuses, if you will. And in this particular case, it was driving across the country with, like, named professional wrestler-type identities. People with David Carradine as the good guy, Sylvester Stallone as one of the bad guys.
Is David Carradine a good guy in this movie? I'm gonna say he's not really. No one's good.
In the context of the situation, yeah. He's better than anyone else is.
That's true. He's like when he hits the devotee or whatever, and, you know, it's because she loves me. And it's like, well, okay, yeah, all right.
There's a scene, for instance, that everyone always sees the clip of and doesn't realize the context of it, where he's driving through a hospital and all these people go flying in the air. And the reason that's such a big scene is because the hospital has taken all these, like, infirm and elderly patients and put them out in the street for the drivers to hit for points, which he thinks is kind of horrible. So instead, he takes a turn into the side lane and kills all the doctors and nurses,
yes.
which is kind of
I'm
awesome.
Always intrigued by these types of movies. It's so obviously not common in our culture, but so common in history. The thought of going to public executions and gladiatorial games and how watching someone be brutally murdered was a form of entertainment.
And
now
catharsism,
it isn't.
I think.
And catharsis. And so the fact that you have this it's usually a futuristic world where we've gone back to that historical context of watching people be brutally murdered, I find fascinating as to why is that not acceptable now when it used to be and apparently is in the future.
Because it showed the absolute darkest side of humanity that we don't want to confront in a commercial way, in an open way, is accurate. The closest we get is watching horror movies to some extent. And one could make the argument, and have, that there is something important in being able to experience fear and violence in an artificial form, because it gets it out of your system rather than the argument a lot of people
totally
in the 70s made. But as far as it not being there to see for real anymore, anytime anybody ever dies and they've got the footage, that shit will be on the internet forever.
Ever, yep.
Because people still do want to see it. Yep. They can't help themselves. Nope. Death is the biggest mystery, or at least, you know, so we like to say.
Yes.
It's going to happen to every single one of us one day, so people are fascinated by it. It's one of the reasons why horror movies are, in fact, so successful. It's one of the reasons why people wanted to see other people get killed. It made them forget about their own limited mortality for a while, I suppose.
Yeah.
Plus, fuck that guy. He owes me $20.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway, Clockwork Orange is next up, which is, I think, genuinely one of the most disturbing films with its use of violence ever made. Now, that being said, everything it's doing with violence is perfectly on point. None of it is there just to be titillating for the point of violence. In fact, any points, it's to make the point that aren't you gross for being titillated?
Yeah,
by
basically.
I just know the author hated the movie because they changed the ending.
You know, whatever. Stephen King hated The Shining and still does. So.
My dad didn't watch me very well growing up. And that's one of the movies my dad showed me. And I was like that older teenager at the time. But still, you know, I was like, what is wrong with you, Dad?
I definitely stumbled across this as a teenager because it was my parents would never have approved it being shown to me. But it was one of the movies that everybody at a certain point you've heard about.
Yeah.
And you're like, that sounds insane. I've got to see that.
You know the imagery.
Yes.
Very few people at a young age are as strong as they think they are when they actually encounter seriously sitting down and watching A Clockwork Orange. It's a distressing film, but it's a cult film, for sure.
I was wrong. Buckaroo Banzai is not the only one I haven't seen. I've never seen A Clockwork Orange, but I've seen every Simpson reference to it.
Well, now you have to. Now you have to see it. Clockwork Orange, of course, has to be on here. Blade Runner. Okay, I guess it is. It's become such a huge part of the world and our culture at this point. Mm-hmm. Like, Blade Runner and everything that happened in the changes because of Blade Runner, that it's weird to think of it as a cult film. But it totally is. The movie bombed when it came out. I mean, open versus E.T., so you be the judge.
Like, it was E.T., and it was...
It had no chance. And audiences didn't know what to do with a very long, arty, ethereal, sci-fi noir film
that movie.
A lot of which was just thinking.
Ridley Scott doesn't know what to do with that film, considering how many redos he's done of it.
Yeah, Kevin Pollak had one of his few jokes on here where he said, oh, I prefer the niece's cut.
Yes, I like that.
I think this is unquestionably a masterpiece. Yes. It is deeply, to its core, affected the way that we think about science fiction. Mm-hmm. Like, there's...
Definitely.
Like, more than any other film except for Star Wars, I would say this has affected the way people visualize science fiction.
Yeah.
For certain. More than Star Trek, even, because this is just... shows up in everything, the styles that came from Blade Runner. So yes, it, I guess it's important to start talk about as a cult film, but it's one of those, like, I think we've explored this one. And of course, yeah. Sean Young is somebody who's willing to show up and talk about it because she's never seen a paycheck she didn't like.
She's doing fine.
I talk shit. I like Sean Young. Yes. She's apparently can be a little difficult to work with on set.
I've heard that as well.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
She must use the Senate's philosophy, but
I bet she does.
So next up is A Brother from Another Planet. This is the only one on this list I haven't seen in like 20 years.
My husband, Michael, like, you haven't seen this? Like, no. I've never even heard of this movie. And
me neither.
He's like, no, we're going to watch it. So now we've got like a date to go watch it.
It looks great.
It is great. It's a lot slower and less science fiction-y than the rest of these. It's much more of a very human story, despite it being about a black guy who's from another planet. Joe Morton, who's famously, much more famously to wider audiences, became known as the scientist in Terminator 2, mm-hmm. where they had to convince that his invention was going to destroy everyone.
He was also in Eureka.
It's a cool little quiet movie, but it's definitely the least sci-fi-y of any of them. And they spend some time exploring this with Joe Morton. But I always like that guy. Then we have Liquid Sky, which is definitely the cultiest of the culty films on this list. Much as I've criticized some of the choices in the first one and the second one and say I've kind of, not in that they were bad choices for the purposes of this movie, but that I would have liked to have seen things that fall a little further down the cult scale and weren't quite as well known.
Yeah.
Liquid Sky is one of those ones I'm like, yeah, this totally should be on this list because it's totally insane. It is for very few of you. My wife was watching this doc with me and she was like, I gotta see this fucking film. How did I not know this existed? I'm like, okay, it's for her. But, you know, this is like an extended 80s German krautrock new wave video.
It sounds on the surface amazing. But like when you start talking about like little tiny invisible aliens, I'm like, okay, well.
There are little miniature aliens that hover on people's roofs and they basically kill them by when they shoot up drugs, heroin, mm-hmm. they absorb all the serotonin rushing into their brain, which kills the person.
Or having an orgasm.
Well, later they figure that out, that orgasms are even better. And they end up sort of camping out in a symbiotic relationship with this one girl who both has friends who come over to do heroin and who have sex with her and each other a lot. And it just sort of hangs out and kills anyone who comes to the place. She starts to figure out what's up and starts basically going, hey, I got a weapon I can use here against people who wronged me. It's a really bizarre movie that is highly worth watching. I don't think they do it justice here in the documentary of how weird this movie really is. It's almost ambient.
If anything, they leave it vague enough for you to want to go see it.
If you're one of those people who can take a movie that doesn't have almost any plot at all, but is all just crazy visual experiences and is just Germany new wave in the 80s, this is your thing. lastly, is one of my favorite cult films of all time, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
I want to see it.
I just got the book for Christmas this year. They re-released finally the original book that was written to go with it that has all the stuff they cut out, that is a lot of which cut out of the script, not the film itself that was never filmed.
The film
insinuates at the end coming next, Buckaroo Banzai against the World Crime League. And in the original script for this, then the original book, there's a lot of stuff that actually involves the World Crime League and the leader of that. Well, he was cut out entirely of the movie except for that little reference there. But this is really one of the only truly good super scientist superhero movies. Like, other people have tried. There's been a Doc Savage movie that's not very good. Mm-hmm. There's a couple others out there. But generally speaking, super scientists never really sell. I mean, look around right now. Not really surprising to see why scientists as a superhero are a hard sell with the world we live in.
Yeah. What, you mean the Fantastic Four was not a good movie?
Oh, any of them. Any of them, no.
You mean Elon Musk is not a super scientist?
I think he thinks he is. Huh. But yeah, this had a great cast of people in it. Like I said, Peter Weller is the lead. This talks to Jeff Goldblum, who apparently is going to be in all of these. And Jeff Goldblum's always a riot. I mean, who would kick Jeff Goldblum out? He's so funny, just the way he talks.
Well, I like how the last documentary ended with
Gary Busey,
and then now this one's kind of ending with Jeff Goldblum. It's like, I hope they have like a really weird actor for all of them. Like, almost my favorite part is when they're just like, here, y'all just talk.
Jeff Goldblum is like neutral weird, though. Gary Busey is like chaotic weird.
So maybe we need a good weird, so maybe that'll be
it. Was Sean Young in this one? Yes. She was the one who was kind of crazy weird. Although they should have just let her kept going, because it feels like they cut her off too early. Like, wait, let her go. Keep going. Bring up something that pisses her off. Let's see what happens. Buckaroo Banzai is one of my favorites, but this is where this ends. I feel like I'd recommend all of them, really. I mean, even like I said, that some people are very strongly against The Human Centipede. That movie is great if you view it like it was intended, like a really bizarre comedy. It's pretty fucking funny, and it's not gory at all. I like everything on this list.
They did have the questionable ones, though. Like I said, Clockwork Orange is the most glaring example. It's like, you can't be a cult film and also get Oscar nods.
Well, I mean, they acknowledge even in here, this is like the only film we're talking about that in its own time was a big hit and was acknowledged as being great.
Doesn't that mean it's not a cult movie?
Yeah, I get why you want to include it, because it is so fucking weird. But there's other examples of movies that are that weird that won Oscars and were celebrated that you're not putting on your list. And I feel like this is just one because you remember it from when you were young.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it felt like that was a personal decision more than one that made sense in the context of this list.
Okay. Yeah.
That's unfortunately always going to be the issue with documentaries like these, is there are movies that you know should be on here that they just might not be.
Like, we're Six String Samurai.
Let's go to final thoughts. Let's see. How about Mindy? What do you think?
A lot of the issues I had with this part of the documentary are the same issues that I had with the first part, which is each of the films that were presented essentially as self-contained entities. There didn't seem to be a lot of cohesiveness in how it was presented. And for me, it's like when I'm watching a documentary, that's important. I want to know how things influenced other things. I want to know what the effect was on the world at large. Something that connects it to relevance. When you self-contain it like that, it takes that away. And that said, I love the fact that everybody they talk to loves these films. Mm-hmm. When it felt like they had a lot more people who were connected to each of the films, either as a critic or as a filmmaker. And so you got a more personal story for each of these films than it did the first installation, which I really appreciated. The panel was redundant and stupid and could have completely been cut out. There was no reason for it. I am going to give it 7.5 feathers coming up off the floor of what is now a B&B in Texas.
Yeah, I was thinking to myself, like, well, why didn't they just keep the feathers on the floor? It's like, oh yeah, because every time someone walked, they'd get feathers in their food. So.
Like, this is in my coffee. It's like, it's part of ambiance. Deal with it.
Just be glad we didn't stick you on a meat hook. Come on.
You want to come back to the kitchen?
Like the people who were your lunch. Yes, exactly. Harmony, what do you think?
I've enjoyed both of these documentaries so far. I'm just like not a huge gore person, like I said. So it was like, I watched it, but I was like, hold on. I was like, please let the gory parts be over. You know, but I watched the whole thing. People love these films. People are really passionate about these films. People who worked for them or who have great nostalgia for them. That's contagious, you know, for lack of a better word. Like you can tell that these people really love what they do and they love these movies. The stories are great. And for that reason, I'm going to give it 8 out of 10 dimensions. You didn't see that coming, did you? No, there's 10 out there now.
Adrian.
With this clocking in at about 1 hour 20 minutes, it's really hard for me to be able to fully recommend this. If you're a horror fan, you've heard most of these stories. And if you're not really familiar with any of these movies, it's not enough to make you want to sit down and watch this, I would say. It's a little disappointing. And I know it seems weird because I've said a lot of positive things about it. It's definitely well made and the interviews are, it's entertaining enough to get by, but it's hard to say to go out and get this ASAP. I do want to mention that the panel, it literally looks like they're just waiting to pick up their food that they just ordered.
Craft services, hello, where are you?
Yeah, they're just waiting to pick it up to go home and smoke out and eat and watch these movies that they're about to talk about. Mm. And a bunch of other things that I miss doing. But I would give this 3 Bruce Campbell appearances out of 5 because I love that guy.
Yeah,
he is the best. Adrian, you and I are coming pretty close on this one, and for the same reasons. Part of the biggest problem with the second one, sci-fi and horror, is that nobody loves to talk more about the things that they like than sci-fi and horror fans, which means these films have been that covered extensively in multiple other places, much more so than the films in the first one or that are going to be in the third one, which is more of a comedy thing, which is an odd choice for cult, I feel like, because how do you decide whether a comedy is a cult comedy or not, other than not having qualities of sci-fi and horror in it. That being said, this is very competent versions of looks into all these films. Some of them are more fun than others. I kind of wish that this one especially had gone a little bit wilder with its choices. There are some interesting ones in here, for sure, some interesting choices. Oh, I forgot. Also, Dieter Laser from The Human Centipede is dead as well.
Oh my, he is killing people. We've got to do something, Chris. It's up to us.
L.A. Documentary Massacre. I think this is fine. I still like the first one better just for the newer information, but this is good. If you're not somebody like me and Adrian who's watched every documentary ever made about all these different films and all the bonus features that came on Arrow re-releases of them, then there is going to be some really cool stuff. And I think it's got a good pace. Once again, Mindy, I have to say, I do not understand why you're so hung up on the thing with them not having a connection. They do have a connection. They're all sci-fi and horror cult films.
But they're so random.
No, they're not. They're sci-fi and horror cult films. What other connection do you need? I don't think that this, when you're looking at a list of things that are supposed to be taking out a genre, that they have to have where one affects the other. I think it's literally called the greatest cult films ever made.
I at least want it to have a chronological significance.
I don't know. It didn't really bug me at all. I mean, it wasn't called the history of cult films. It was called the greatest cult films ever made. And more on why they chose the movies that they did, in fact, in my interview with the producer, Paul Fishbein, which comes right after this. You can listen to him answer some of the questions we posed in the first one and in the second one. But to wrap all this up, I'm going to give this a 7 out of 10 impressions Kevin Pollak never made. Still kind of pissed off about that. Man, have you ever watched him just go on a run where he's one after another? He's one of the best people in the world at it.
He got a paycheck. I mean,
I'm like, what are you doing? You got this guy. Poke him with a stick.
Yep.
Hey, Paul, how are you?
How you doing?
Well, you are the producer of Time Warp, the greatest cult films of all time, the 3-part documentary film series that we already reviewed part one of, which I was super excited to get to see because I am an old school cult film fanatic. Obviously, you are too, for wanting to put this together in the first place.
Absolutely. I mean, these are the movies I grew up on. These are the movies I cut classes to see. These are the movies that I couldn't wait to take people and tell them I know what the next great thing is. So yeah, this is a lifelong dream project that finally came to fruition.
There's so many great cult films to choose from, and you've picked a wonderful assortment of ones, but even so, it had to be driving you crazy of what stuff you had to leave out and what to include. How did you ultimately pick what stuff to choose for each one of these chapters?
We had our director, Danny Wolf, and our supervising producer, Christine Augustin, and Irv Slifkin, who was our other producer, who is from Philadelphia, where I'm from, who's a film professor and a longtime film author. We came up with a list of probably 250 cult films, and it was, obviously the ones that we love, plus, you read Danny Peary's seminal 3-part cult film book series, yeah. And you really can come up with a lot of films. And so we came up with probably 250 legitimate choices. We were originally going to do one single documentary. It was only once we got deep into the research that we said, it's a much deeper dive, and let's see if we can raise more money. So you basically have to say to yourself, what are the essential films that if you don't have in there, you're going to get ridiculed for? So it's Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's Pink Flamingos. It's Harold and Maude. It's the ones that really define midnight movies and cult films in the 70s that have to be included. Then you kind of look at your next group and you say to yourself, well, what needs to be included? So you look at like something like The Room and you say, well, that has to be included because that has the only film that's really replicated the Rocky Horror experience. And that represents kind of a new era. And, you know, you kind of look at movies like that. And then you sort of say to yourself, okay, here's our second group of films. Now, who can we get to talk? So when you see something like Big Lebowski, which is a legitimate cult film that was not a hit when it first came out, but that did find its audience later, you include it because you were able to get Jeff Bridges and John Turturro. Yeah. And so obviously you're going to include that. But something like The Harder They Come, which is a legitimate one of the five seminal midnight movies that started the trend – we left it out because we couldn't get Jimmy Cliff. And it almost felt like, well, if you can't get Jimmy Cliff, then why have The Harder They Come? So you have to make really hard choices. We had Phantom of the Paradise scheduled, and we couldn't get Paul Williams, and we couldn't get Brian De Palma. Subsequently, once we finished the film, ironically, our investor went into a new project with Paul Williams, but it was too late to include Phantom of the Paradise. But if we do another volume later, we will include that. And then, you know, you sort of say to yourself, well, we want Pam Grier. We got Pam Grier. So you include Coffee and Foxy Brown. And you sort of work months and months and months, and who can you get that will go on camera? And so some stuff gets cut out because, like, for example, one film that we wanted to include was From Dusk Till Dawn. Mm-hmm. Now, we had Tom Savini because he had been talking about Dawn of the Dead. And we had Fred Williamson, who had been talking about the blaxploitation films. But we couldn't get George Clooney and we couldn't get Robert Rodriguez. And so we kind of said, well, From Dusk Till Dawn's kind of on the cusp and it's running a little long. So we're going to leave that one out. But we have the interviews in case we get somebody else to do it. So, you know, somebody like, just a good example, was Rob Reiner said yes right away. So that led us to get Fran Drescher and Michael McKean for Spinal Tap.
You watch it and you never think once, oh, these films were chosen more because of who they could get. Everything feels, yeah, this belongs here.
Well, if you notice, Harold and Maude is in there, but we didn't have anybody from the movie. Bud Cort, who we got in contact with and spoke to, was kind of offended that we called Harold and Maude a cult film. He said, it's just one of the greatest films ever made. It's not a cult movie. And we're like, well, it really is a cult movie. And he didn't want to do the interview. But you still had to include Harold and Maude. You couldn't leave it out. So it's sort of like choices. You know, we ended up with almost 50 films and out of 250. And you could easily have taken 20 out and put in 20 others in and nobody would have complained. We are hearing things like, well, you left out El Topo. Well, you're right. We left out El Topo because we just couldn't fly to Spain to interview the director. There was nobody else to talk to. But – you know, Reefer Madness we had to include because it's Reefer Madness. So, you know, you make choices and then people comment. And part of the fun is the arguing. You know, you left this out or this isn't a cult film. I mean, we're getting really, really good reviews. We're 92% positive on Rotten Tomatoes as of today. So I'm happy with that. If people are angry because we left their favorite film out, they probably have a legitimate argument.
If this was, you know, you had your props completely, it didn't matter. You could, like, you could cover whatever you wanted and it made sense. Like, let's just say imaginary world, you can get whoever you want, but that's not your reason for doing these. What cult films would you, like your favorites, do you wish you could have included in here?
Well, my favorites are in here because my favorites are Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, mm-hmm. and Pink Flamingos and Spinal Tap and Harold and Maude, which is really what started me on my cult film fanaticism because my 12th grade journalism teacher recommended the movie, and I went to the TLA cinema, which was the first rep cinema in Philadelphia, to see Harold and Maude and King of Hearts. So, and by the way, King of Hearts could have been on this list as well.
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah. We would have liked to include Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but we couldn't get Paul Reubens. I mean, there are some, but I think most of my favorites are right there, you know?
But you're still even like, but we'd like to do a fourth one.
Oh, we're on board for fourth, fifth, and sixth. We have another couple hundred films that we could cover. We have themes. We'll do it. It just, this has to be successful. So if it's successful, and if after the VOD releases, we get a decent streaming deal, then maybe we will do four, five, and six.
Man, I'm super excited to hear that, because so far I'm really enjoying these. Once again, that was Paul Fishbein, the producer of Time Warp, the greatest cult films of all time. We still have this is at the tail end of our second review, and we're going to be putting out a third one as well.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
But thanks so much, Paul. You guys check it out. You can get it on VOD right now. Are there any plans to move to any streaming services, or is it going to be VOD for the immediate future?
Oh, I think up until through the summer, it'll be everything will be available on Amazon. You know, we rent movies, iTunes and Apple TV, Vudu, Fandango. It's on a bunch of cable systems. Hard to find because their search engines are horrible, but it's on Comcast or Spectrum, Charter, those places. But we will be on a streaming service or more than one streaming service later in the year. I just don't know which one yet.
I'm rooting for Shudder myself. You're perfectly suited for those guys.
No, we love Shudder. Absolutely love it.
Well, thanks so much, and we will talk to you again soon.
All right, thank you so much.